Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Cinematic Universe. I'm your host, Joe Cunningham, and joining me are...
James Hunt.
And Reese Williamson.
So today we will be discussing Matt Reeves' 2022 movie, The Batman. Just the one movie this week. And we had two last time, but just the one. And yeah, that's it really. I was trying to think if I had anything else to riff on with the Batman, and I didn't. I don't know. Who wants to be vengeance of the three of us?
I've already said that I am vengeance, I think, on the prequel. So that's I'll take that, I suppose.
Then it's Reese.
Whatever that means, slash for the podcast or the movie, because anyway, we'll get to it.
We will get to it. So as this is a new release, we won't have any news this week. We will have a spoiler-free discussion of The Batman, which will probably be quite brief, given James has already given his spoiler-free thoughts on the podcast. But if anyone wasn't listening to that episode, like me...
You weren't.
then it would be great to hear those thoughts, maybe briefly. And then we will go into a full spoiler-filled discussion of The Batman. But before any of that, I need to switch things up a little bit this week and do a bit of podcast admin. So sorry,
everyone loves the podcast admin.
Sorry, listeners, if you were hoping to have something explained to you that maybe you didn't understand, you will. It's just admin. Kind of a big podcast announcement. We are changing the format of how this podcast lands both on the main feed and on Patreon. So moving forwards, after this episode, the main feed will become a monthly show. That show will be full of a month's worth of news, and we'll have some other discussions sprinkled in, which, you know, we'll probably figure out on a month-by-month basis. Meanwhile, over on the Patreon, which will be the same cost that it always has been, we will continue to discuss all of the Disney Plus Marvel episodes on a week-by-week basis, and we will cover any new release movies over there. So any new movies that come out that are superhero-based, you know, the ones that we would normally cover on the main feed, will now be on the Patreon. What we will also start to do is put any archive posts from the Patreon live on the main feed a year after they have been on the Patreon. So if you do still want to hear everything for free, you will be able to, just on a year's delay. Now, obviously a big change, a number of reasons for this. And I think some life news, I'm having another baby. Well, my wife is having another baby, but I contributed.
You played your part.
Yes. And obviously, last time I had a baby, I stepped away from the podcast and was gone for a year. And we were trying to figure out basically how it would be, you know, possible to continue. And also kind of, we've also kind of reached the point with the main feed episodes where we
can't face watching any more comic movies.
Well, we've kind of exhausted all of the stuff that would justify episodes on their own. So, you know, increasingly over the past year, we've been grouping stuff together. And, you know, we thought that if ever anything does come up that we really want to talk about from that archive, that can be an opportunity to sprinkle that in, you know, on the main feed, but that will be on those news episodes, and it will be if we're really compelled to do it. What we don't want to do is go like, oh,
watch Barbed Wire again.
Yeah, I guess we're gonna do an episode on those movies there because we haven't covered them, even though we don't really want to watch them or talk about them.
I think that would be fun
for anyone.
I think anyone who listened to this year's Cuppies can see the huge disparity in the quality of new movies that are coming out and the quality of archive movies we've been covering.
Yes, it's starting to become slimmer pickings. So this was a way, basically, that enabled us to continue doing the podcast. Still, I think, overall putting out a lot of content and still making all of the content available eventually for everyone. Also, you know, demands on our time and the funds to keep this podcast going, just justify it to our other halves or... In Reese's case, his flatmate.
My flatmate. Yeah, we have a monthly budget meeting that I think crosses boundaries, but I mean, he puts it in my diary, so hey.
So yeah, we will. It will still remain £3 a month on the Patreon to subscribe to everything. There's still that £1 tier to get ad free versions of the main feed episodes as well.
And we're going to be covering Moon Knight soon.
We'll be covering Moon Knight soon. And then as we have, you know, we are now a year removed from launching the Patreon in the first place, at which point we said we wouldn't make any changes for a year. We didn't. And so a year later, this change is happening. But that doesn't mean we've got a year's worth of archived Patreon posts, which can start going up on the main feed if you haven't heard them already, or, you know, just want to listen to them again a year on. So, yeah, hopefully that's not too devastating news for everyone. There will still be main feed content. It will be, you know, fairly regular. We're going to aim to put it out probably around the first of every month with news and nonsense, I would say. And then, yeah, Patreon, new movies, new Disney Plus episodes. And there's a lot of those, so there's still going to be a lot of content.
Because also, hopefully, with the new main feed format, you know, just the slight loosening up of that format, I think will be a fun hang, a nice listen. I feel like sometimes we've gotten, you know, because we've got these rigid little sort of features that we do, and plus the spoiler-free, spoiler-filled with guests, all that kind of stuff. I like to think that these monthly main feed episodes will be, you know, 90 minutes of the month's news acting as a kind of, you know, kind of clothes hanger for just us to hang out and
I can tell you now, there's going to be a lot more comics discussion.
Yeah, great.
I can slip that in now.
Excellent.
Yeah, we can talk about, you know, I know, Joe, I feel like you've always wanted to have a bit of a window to talk about stuff that you've just been watching recently, yeah, whether it's new stuff or old stuff, you know, a little
maybe that'll come back in there.
We can. And similarly, final point is that Patreon stuff's going to be, it's basically all of the really juicy new releases that
all killer,
we're going
no
to want to talk about. Yeah, and kind of, I think same, and then the main feed's going to be all fun stuff. There you go.
Cool, there we go.
Taglines.
So that's the future of the podcast. But right now, we need to move into a spoiler-free territory and discuss The Batman. Reese, do you want to go first? If I'm right in thinking, and as I say, I never listened to James's take on The Batman, James has revealed, you know, little bits and pieces in the background. I believe, James, it is your favourite ever Batman movie.
Yes,
with the caveat that you're not a huge Nolan guy. Is that an understatement?
Yeah, even if I was a Nolan fan, I think I would prefer this one. I've seen this one twice now, and if anything, I liked it slightly more the second time.
Wow. So you're all in on The Batman?
I'm definitely all in, yeah.
Okay, Reese.
Okay, so for context, I've seen this movie twice as well. Now, my first viewing was... I've recently got a new little job, which is great. Clap, you know, pause for applause. It's a lot of extra work. I work at a cinema. So I was at my place of work and I'd worked 70 hours that week. I was very tired, but I decided, no, for the good of mankind, I simply must watch The Batman. I will just quickly have 4 pints first. So what happened was then I did fall asleep, genuinely fell asleep for the whole middle hour of the film. And so canonically had no take on the Batman, but I thought like, oh, there was a cool bit with a car and a cool bit with a jump. Then I watched it a week later properly, liked it. I can't remember the movie. And I think that's my controversial kind of take. I think it's a bit ephemeral. And we can get into all the comparisons to all the previous Batmans, but that broadly, I think it's not doing enough different to make any kind of impact, to leave any kind of impact. And I think it's a good Batman movie from an interesting director, but that the movie is just not got enough interesting ideas, new ideas, you know. And maybe it's impossible to make a new Batman film with new ideas, properly new ideas, to make a kind of an impact like those Nolan movies did. And they did do that, especially the second one. And Pattinson's great, and the suit looks cool, and there's all these little pieces that work, and it works as a whole. But yeah, I think that's my take. It's a really hard challenge to make an impactful new Batman film. And I don't think this is one of those, but maybe the sequel will be, and maybe this is a foundation for the future. But I liked it. I liked it. It was fun. I'd watch it again, but it's not different enough, I don't think.
Okay. So where am I on the Batman? So do you know what? I thought it was really interesting that a lot of the reviews that came out kind of, you know, the instant, the embargo has broken, must drop pithy thoughts on Twitter. So a lot of those thoughts seem to be split into this is great, really dug it, really works. You know, we've got the start of a new Batman franchise here. Can't wait to see more of it. And the other side that was like, fucking hell, like that was such a drag. It's bad. It's got nothing to say. It doesn't, you know, the retake, it doesn't say anything different. And
I didn't say it was bad.
No. That you said it had nothing new to say. So that, yeah. I was literally just picking that part out from you. But yeah, that kind of really like, I can empathize with the people who thought that this movie, like that were half an hour into this movie and went, oh my God, there is another 2.5 hours of this. And I can empathize because I think if you didn't like this movie, it would be so fucking punishing. Do you know what I mean? Because it is so, it knows exactly what it wants to be tonally. And it hits that tone in the first 5 minutes and it stays there. And for me, I kind of really dug the first hour. I was having a really great time with I was like, oh yeah, I think I can get on board with this kind of like, really morose neo-noir. I liked what Pattinson was doing. I liked that Gotham felt like this comic book city. I liked that it wasn't overly burdened with law other than the stuff that you kind of like at this point take for granted with Batman. I think it started to lose me a little bit every time it went back to the Riddler. I don't think this is Paul Dano's finest performance. I don't think he's a very interesting villain. And I think as well, the stuff that I was really into in terms of like the plot machinations of the film was the past of Batman. Like what was the kind of him trying to extricate his past and the like and the mysteries around like the crime setup of Gotham. I was kind of into that. And then when the film showed its hand in terms of what was going on there, I was like, oh, well, is that as interesting as I thought it could be? And then when we finally saw the Riddler, and I don't think this is a spoiler, because when you finally see him, he's Paul Dano, and we all know who Paul Dano is, and like it's not there can't be a shock twist with the reveal of that character because he is exactly what we expect him to be. And so I struggled a little bit more in the final hour because of that. but I think I liked enough things about it to have an enjoyable 3 hours at the cinema, because I liked Pattinson, I liked Zoe Kravitz, I liked the commitment to that tone, even if it did contribute to it feeling like a 3 hour movie. But yeah, so I would say, like, I know what Reese is saying. I think that I don't know if you could come to this with like anything new to say about Batman as a character that hasn't been said already, unless you want to go and do something radically different. And this isn't radically different, but it is very much its own vision. And I liked enough of the ingredients that I thought, yeah, I could come back and see more of this, I think.
There is one thing I want to say on that point, is that I think this film does do some things which explicitly mark this version of Batman out, sort of philosophically, from the other versions.
Yeah.
And I think we'll get to those things later, but I was kind of intrigued by the points that I saw as being sort of explicit rejections of both Snyder and Nolan's version of Batman. Like, not in a very dismissive way, but in a more sort of constructive, this is what I think Batman's about, rather than those things way.
I think I know what one of those is. But yeah, we can get into them.
Yeah,
I do roundly reject the idea that this film isn't about anything. I do think it has stuff on its mind. But yeah, I couldn't really get into that without getting really spoilery. So we'll talk about that in the spoiler section. Sorry, go on, Reece.
I found myself, one more comment. I found myself thinking that the next day after the second viewing, maybe, or the first, I found myself thinking about comparing this to Spider-Man Homecoming. You know, yeah. In terms of like a kind of a really, I know that actually there hasn't been a solo Batman movie for kind of a good chunk of time, but it doesn't feel that way in the culture. It sort of feels like Batman is 10 years? Ever present.
Was Dark Knight Rises 2012?
But you know, you've got the Affleck stuff, and there's the TV stuff, and you know,
Lego it does Batman.
Therefore, I was kind of thinking, I wondered whether I wanted something a bit more like Homecoming versus The Amazing Spider-Man. You know, with that was a very short, relatively short period of time, and I know that. Yes, he's in the Marvel Universe. That's one of the differences. But also, you know, I thought they did a smart job of shuffling up the supporting cast, shuffling up, you know, the fact that we don't really see Spider-Man in those movies swinging around New York until that third film. I thought that was a choice that made things just feel a bit fresher. I wondered whether, I think I wanted something a bit more like that for this, that just.
So I guess,
you know, did I want him interacting with the Riddler and Catwoman again and Gordon? But then also, maybe these are just so core to the character that these are your tools for telling a Batman story.
Well, the Riddler's a character that hasn't been on screen for over 25 years. In fairness, sure. and it is a different. I guess if I was to say what is the new thing that they bring in terms of like the basic setup of the character, it is the you know, the detective angle, that is his, you know, this isn't a very action heavy film. He is doing detecting, sometimes not very well, often if not always not very well, but that's different. And then I think that the main difference for me, and this is where I don't know if this is why I haven't listened to much of Matt Reeves talking about this movie. I wonder whether this is why it's called The Batman, because this felt like the heaviest Batman movie to me. Like there's barely any Bruce Wayne, or like the difference between the two of them feels so slim, that, you know, he basically, you know, and this, I think, I can't remember whether the movie is explicit with this or whether it's just very pointed, that like in this, the Batman is him and Bruce Wayne is the facade. And I know that is to a degree with some previous versions, but this felt like the truest form of that. He just spends so much of this movie in the mask. And that felt slightly different to me.
Slightly. as the word, though.
Yeah.
Because I went and watched The Dark Knight since in the last week, and again, we can talk about it, that movie is pretty good. But I thought it was interesting how they do refer to the character in that movie as the Batman. They do. Mm. So I get that the branding does look different. You know, the movie wasn't called The Batman Begins, or I guess it was called The Dark Knight. I think that's a bit of a marketing trick. This one's really different because it's giving the character a definite article.
I just wondered if that was one of the reasons they leaned into that, because it felt like the Batman-iest of the Batman movies.
I think you've been tricked there, Joe, I'm afraid to say. You've been tricked by the Brothers Warner.
So the Riddler had a hand in it. Okay, those were our spoiler-free thoughts on the Batman. So we'll take a brief break now, listen to the trailer, and come back with our spoiler-filled discussion of Matt Reeves' movie.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Police! Hands up! Stay still!
Is a tool. But when that light hits the sky, it's not just a call. It's a warning.
I've been trying to reach you.
Burn the gun!
Riddler's the match.
I can take care of myself.
If this continues, it won't be long before you've nothing left.
I don't care what happens to me.
It's only gonna get worse for you.
Whoa, take it easy, sweetheart. Hear everything they say, ain't you?
Maybe we're not so different. Who are you under there?
I'm vengeance.
What's black and blue and dead all over?
I got you!
Okay, so that was the trailer for The Batman. This is now our spoiler-free... No, spoiler-filled. Fuck.
God, what's wrong with you?
I mean, I'm getting... I'm talking in riddles. Yeah, this is our spoiler-filled discussion of The Batman.
Joker.
Yeah, should we just start with the one thing that feels spoilery in this movie?
We're here. We're past the joke.
You know, I was sitting there at the towards the end of this movie when he got put in Arkham. I was sitting there going like, "Oh fuck! If Joaquin Phoenix turns up, I'm just gonna leave." Like, I was so scared they were gonna really fuck up all this goodwill that had built up.
No, it's my boy Druig. It's Druig, baby.
Barry Keoghan cameoing as unseen Arkham prisoner, although. Definitely seen. I did wonder
also,
actually.
Fucking fifth build or something, right? His billing is mad.
Yeah, because I remember when, like, I'm sure I mentioned that on the podcast previously that he was in this. And I'd had this spoiled for me already before I went in. But I wonder whether that this is because it doesn't feel like the movie needs that kind of moment there. I wonder whether there was an impulse to go, look, we're not going to do the Joaquin Phoenix thing, so should we just make it explicit that we're not going to do that?
Yeah, although apparently I've seen Matt Reeves talking about it, and he said there was actually an earlier scene with that character as well, where they like his intention was to try and sort of give the idea of a kind of burgeoning undercurrent of supervillainy kind of rising in Gotham.
A version with Joaquin Phoenix?
No, with Barry Keoghan, but more of him threaded throughout the movie. And in the end, actually, we only need that one cameo.
And there's thugs at the start of the movie, like the Gotham that they introduce here. It felt very like Arkham video game to me.
That was the touchstone that I came away with. Like quite early on, I was like, "Oh, that was very much like the Arkham games, which I love." So,
but like having like gangs in and around Gotham, like this Gotham is such a shithole. it's raining all the time.
It's Glasgow, right?
it's half Glasgow, very half tough. Chicago. I think that's where they filmed this time.
I know where the shitty stuff was filmed.
They
sorry, Glasgow region. I don't mean that.
Yeah, but they had the gang, didn't they? That like had right the, for the first Batman encounter that had
Robin in it,
clownish kind of makeup. Did it have Robin? Who's Robin?
Don't we think that guy is Robin?
Do we?
What?
Why?
No, guys, no. Why? The guy who's like he gets pushed forward to hit the guy, and then he doesn't. Then he pushes the gun away from, and he's also in Titans as a Robin. I just to say.
Oh, is he?
Do you guys not know that? No. That could be Robin or Signal, right, James? That's a newer Robin.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, sorry,
I didn't get that from the movie. I'll say that.
I've been reading too many CBR.com. I suppose,
but that's not. Maybe, yeah, that's not something I got from that moment in the film.
Okay, but let's go back to Joker. And can I draw attention
but the point I was making around Joker was that I did wonder at that point, like, oh, is that a Joker gang? Is there a Joker already out there in Gotham? And I guess for him to be in Arkham suggests that the Joker has done something already to get there.
Indeed. But I didn't really listen to that. I was doing a Google. I was going to say, here's an interesting point. So the gap between Batman 89 and The Dark Knight, which is 89 to 08, is 19 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if let's presume that the sequel to this comes out in 2 years, which I think it's on the docket for 2024, the gap between The Dark Knight and that will be 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I know, again, it's sort of back to the point about feeling like this Batman and Joker and all this shit is it's continually in the ether. But actually, that's a very comparable gap between cinematic Batman v Joker stories. I just thought that was interesting and worth bringing to the group.
Yeah, I mean, there was a movie headlined Joker a few years ago.
Yeah, but Batman wasn't in it. That's the point.
Bruce Wayne was in it.
Yeah, he was a little boy, and he didn't throw any kind of a knife.
And Joaquin Phoenix did not kick him in the face, which I was very disappointed.
Someone's forgetting the final scene in the Snyder Cut.
But that's why it's all in the ether. But actually, there hasn't. Yeah. That I think also contributes to why Keegan is in the sort of stinger to this, and presumably is going to be the villain in the next one, as opposed to. Is in the stinger for Batman 2 and then is in the third one. Because Joker made a fucking ass load of money and won Oscars. And there's just something, you know, you can deny all you want, you know, you can laugh it off all you want, and that's what he would like. But there's something about the Joker that just plugs into the culture. It's a properly kind of eternal way, not Chloe Zhao's eternal.
I wasn't fully hyped by this. I thought it went on for a bit too long, the actual sequence itself, and whatever they were doing with the makeup, the design of the character, I didn't love. But I could see, and I know Matt Reeves has gone, oh, well, maybe that won't be the villain in the sequel. Maybe we'll do something else. I'm like, come on, mate. But I could see that. I could see a Barry Keoghan Joker and Robert Pattinson's Batman doing the whole, not maybe a direct adaptation, but doing the vibe of the Killing Joke of he just wants to make this Batman laugh. Because that does feel like a genuine challenge with this character. this feels like that's that on the page version of Batman who is so serious that
why so serious?
He would never crack a smile in front of the Joker. So yeah, I could see that working as a dynamic in a movie. So
and the other thing, there's other sort of Joker Batman comment is that much is made of the fact that Heath Ledger's minutes on screen in The Dark Knight is quite limited actually, and you know, there's been so many comics over the years just really, you know, and on the Heath Ledger thing, the minutes he interacts with Batman, you know, I don't even think there's no scene between Bruce Wayne and Joker, right? There's no scene, their scenes, that they've got a handful of scenes together and that's it. And then again, you go back to 1989 for another cinematic interaction between those two characters. There's something to be said for, you know, what if we really, really dig into that, the dynamic between the two of them, and spend, you know, fucking another 3 hours on that, or if it's two, maybe 6 hours. That in a way, even though it feels like it's been so hashed, maybe it hasn't actually. That dynamic on screen could be portrayed in kind of a new way, maybe.
Yeah, I like I said, I'd be there for it. I think.
I think we've got 80 years of stories that suggest that well is not yet dry.
My biggest issue with the Joker reveal, and it's a huge one, and it makes me sad and makes me cry, is that this means we probably don't get, you know, a trilogy of a Druig spin-off from Eternals. That is, it makes me.
It is a surprise, isn't it? Because you would imagine he would be under contract for Marvel, but.
Yeah.
Maybe they were like, no, you can be in the Batman, it's fine.
What if this is the way that they're trying to set up like a Marvel versus DC movie in 10 years? That Keegan is your nexus point. Keegan is your nexus being. Hey, think about it.
Feels unlikely, but we'll keep it out there. okay, so that was the kind of like little Easter egg at the end of the movie. Let's talk about the rest of the movie, which there's a lot of it. I wanted to start off by addressing what I thought this film was about. I'm going to give you guys my take, and you tell me whether you think this is bullshit or you had a different read or whatever. But I kind of like... I'd seen lots of people talking about this film feeling really Finchery and being Zodiac inspired and Seven. And I just didn't see that. I don't feel like this has ever been the tone of a Fincher movie. I feel like Seven is much lighter on its feet. Zodiac is like, yeah, there's a serial killer, but you know, by the nature of it being a Zodiac movie, we never, or we probably never meet him. You know, that's like it. I don't know. I just was really struggling to see that connected tissue.
I think people are concentrating a bit on the aesthetic there rather than the, you know,
but even aesthetically, psychology. Like I don't know, like this, like I said, like it's a neo-noir, like, and it that's, I don't feel like Fincher has made a neo-noir unless I'm like at Seven is the closest, but yeah.
Anyway,
what I did for me, this felt closer to, like, I saw on the Wikipedia someone had referenced, maybe it was John Turturro, saying that he had based his performance on a character from Chinatown. And that was a movie that I was struck by when I was watching this, because I felt like that if there was something thematically on this film's mind, it wasn't the Batman and the Riddler stuff. It was Gotham as this kind of microcosm of American corruption and this kind of like the cesspool that like of the overrun from the American dream. Like this is what America actually has wrought. You know, it's this horrendous social inequality and, you know, and corruption and, you know, and like it influence of the worst of society that, you know, it going right down to the center of the American political system. And I thought that there were like very pointed moments in this, particularly the assassination of Carmine, which plays out like Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald, like, and to the point that he's a, you know, it like, yeah, it felt
one,
like
one he, criminal assassinated by another.
Well, one criminal assassinated by another, except he isn't. What he's actually assassinated by is like a hidden sniper in a second story room across the road. Like it felt like a direct nod to that. And, you know, obviously the JFK assassination, there is so much wrapped up in the JFK assassination around, like, you know, the corruption of this, you know, revered political figure who maybe had mob links and maybe, you know, was up to stuff that he shouldn't have been. And, you know, like in a very Thomas Wayne-y kind of way, right? That actually, did these people have dirt on him because he'd been banging movie stars and, you know, and hanging around with people he shouldn't have been. And that gave them leverage. And ultimately, you know, it led to his death, if you know, those conspiracy theories are to be believed. And then I also thought that the final sequence in Gotham Square Gardens with the floodwater coming in felt very Hurricane Katrina to me, with the Superdome in New Orleans. And, like, I think, you know, one of, for better or worse, the defining image of that kind of culturally is Kanye West and Mike Myers stood in front of a of a camera and Kanye West saying George Bush hates black people. And, you know, and again, the social inequality that had led to, and, you know, the lack of investment and structure in that city that had, you know, yes, it was a natural disaster, but it was, you know, it crippled the city. And I haven't read anything. I don't know if those are direct references, but the thing that I kept coming back to, and that's why the thing that, about this movie that was the most interesting to me, was the kind of the power structure under the surface in Gotham. And I did find the Carmine reveal kind of underwhelming, but I also liked the setup that it left for future movies of just, now there is a, you know, now there's a void that needs to be filled, yeah.
So that's what the spin-off TV series is actually going to be about. It's about Penguin attempting to fill that void, from what I've read.
Okay, well, I
don't know how interested I am in that, especially.
Which one got cancelled? So like, wasn't the two series and one's
been
cancelled?
It was the Gotham PD one that got cancelled.
That sounds like the good one. That's the interesting one.
The Penguin one is going ahead.
What was the Gotham Police one going to be?
I don't know. I think they... they never actually got so as far as doing it. I think they just sort of said, yeah, we're probably going to do a Gotham spin-off. And then
they read Gotham Central and went, it should be a TV
what
show,
they actually
right?
did was did this Penguin one instead of that.
Okay.
So it wasn't like there were two. It was just that this is the one that emerged.
Does Colin Farrell really want to be in that makeup for a TV show where he's the lead?
Maybe like the opening scene is like a montage where he like is at the gym or like car explosion and he emerges. He's like, oh, I guess I look like this now. I guess I look like this now, hey boys.
But just to go back to your point.
Yes,
I think I think you're right. The film is about that stuff. Like it, that's the kind of thing that I took away from it as well. Is like Matt Reeves trying to use a Batman film to explain like why don't things always get better? Why are they sometimes getting worse?
And this is a guy who would have developed this movie during the Trump presidency. Yeah.
And I think it's very light in its in touching on those themes. Like it could have been a lot more explicit, and I think it's probably better for not tying it to Trump and being a bit more general.
Yes, no, I definitely agree. Having a Trump stand-in in this movie would have been a bad idea, but I liked the idea of riddles.
Riddle me this.
In a society where you have that, you know, and this is why I think it's specifically American, not that America has the most fucked system, because, you know, we're not in much better shape here.
Yeah.
But this, I think for Matt Reeves, this is a specifically American thing. You know, that's a country who, when he's making this film, you know, potentially had its elections hacked, but he's finding out that all of these different influences, you know, even in the best of times, not under Trump, right? Like the power that the NRA wields and other lobbying groups and, you know, some of the ideas that that managed to find their way into Washington and some of the stuff that you know, like I said, some of those national scandals. I thought it was interesting that the movie had so much of that in there and then does talk about stuff like, you know, the inequality and uses Batman's privilege as a way to explore that as well, as like a counterpoint and like how he could have been blind to some of this before now as well.
Well, like you go even, you know, you go back to like Tammany Hall and the like unions and stuff in the early part of the 20th century and the, you know, it's the kind of American political system that has always existed, right?
Yeah.
And it's just a fictionalized version of that. And I think it's not an accident that you know, there are, as you say, so many parallels all over the place. For me, the film that kept springing to mind actually was Motherless Brooklyn. Have you seen that?
No.
It's a similar sort of 2.5 hour plus detective yarn that tries to investigate corruption in New York and tries to say, like, you know, it starts off with a girl getting murdered and this, you know, gumshoe is basically trying to figure out why she'd been killed. And it just, you know, it keeps snowballing and it goes all the way to the top and, you know, to the corruption at the heart of the political system. And I was watching it going like, I love that film and I love this film for the same reasons, because it's tackling the same issues. Just happens this time has Batman in it.
Can I offer a counterpoint? The counterpoint is just that you're not wrong, but that this stuff is in the Nolan movies. You know, it maybe the strokes are broader, but I think about, you know, when you reference, Joe, the Hurricane Katrina sort of reference in the concluding sequence tableau, which I agree with. But you know, I actually don't think that compares with the kind of, you know, the Batman billowing cape in The Dark Knight looking at after Rachel Dawes gets blown up, you know, then he sort of looks at that New York City-esque exploded, you know, that, and that's such 9/11 imagery. It's so linked and you know, the stuff about political corruption and you know, stuff about Bruce's privilege. Like, I just think this comes back to my initial point that you're not wrong that this is in this movie and probably more than in those movies. Yes. But you know, what the whole Bane storyline in the third one, that is quite a textually inherently political point that he's making with that set of characters, and he's not shying away from that.
What is he making there, Nolan?
It's about Anonymous, right?
Occupy. It's the Occupy movement. It's about how awful the Occupy movement is.
Well, sure, but you know, it is a point of view, and
for me, this is distinctly different. I think Nolan has some politics in his movies. I think it's extremely clumsily deployed in that trilogy. And I'm not saying here that I prefer the Batman to those movies, because I like lots of things about those as well. But I think the stuff that Nolan was weaker at, this film is stronger at. I think it's much stronger with its depiction of Gotham and people who live in Gotham as a whole. Because I think, I don't think Nolan ever really figured out what the average person in Gotham City
he certainly
thought about things or reacted to things. And the way he kind of made broad generalizations to try and depict what the heart and soul of Gotham really was contradicted itself from movie to movie.
I was going to say, the stuff with the police went back and forth from they are a corrupt army to they are the heroes of the city.
Yeah.
Between three films, and it was just what do you really think, man?
Yeah, and for me, all of that stuff about privilege or inequality is really surface level in the Dark Knight franchise, because I think it's doing other stuff, and I think it's doing other stuff better. I think specifically, as a broad commentary on why America is fucked. I think this film does a lot better. And also, I think, it's inherent to its point as well that it lands on at the end of I think that this is probably, I think I'm going to guess this is something that James likes about this. I think that the answer this movie comes up with is you're not going to solve this with just another cop. You're not gonna get to the bottom of this with just going out there and trying to brute force the problem away. There needs to be other alternatives, and there needs to be another strategy. And being vengeance is not the answer. So I think on that broad thematic level, I think the movie is successful. But also, I kind of think that's one. I think it's successful in half of the movie, and in the Riddler side of things, where I think it's a bit clumsier on the Riddler side, personally, with what it's trying to do, and certainly the kind of Riddler army that pops up at the end. I was less taken with all of that.
Agreed. You're right.
One of the things that I think about now, before we saw it, no one was shouting louder about how awful it was to have made a 3-hour movie than me. And yet, when I actually got into the film, I sort of think it makes sense. It's the kind of film that you need to immerse yourself in, and you need to spend a lot of time in. It needs to feel like you understand and have lived in that city. And to some extent, that means making it slow and spending a lot of time with the characters and locations and, sort of slowly unraveling it for yourself.
I think he could have still shaved off half an hour.
Yeah, he could have. But it's not the sort of film where I go, I spent half an hour of that bored. The only part for me where I was thinking, and bearing in mind that I've seen it twice, the only part where I was really thinking, do we need this much of this, was the sort of disaster sequence at the end. Part of me thinks if they'd ended it after Falcone died and just done a really quick wrap up after that, it would have been hands down a perfect movie.
And it feels like it ends maybe 3 or 4 times in that sequence as well, and then something else happens.
Do you think part of that, James, is that they are... Do you think that they're setting up a No Man's Land setup for the next movie?
I wonder, just need to deal with that trip. The geography of Gotham in this movie is very interesting.
Explain that to our listeners as well, what No Man's Land is. Explain that to your co-host.
So No Man's Land is a movie where a Batman storyline where there's an earthquake that basically totals Gotham, and the US government sort of says, well, that place is a shithole. It's full of criminals. It's probably better if we just leave it. And so they essentially just fence Gotham off and say...
They escape from New York it.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Great.
And it's a bit, it's James, it's a bit like the setup in the second or the last third of The Dark Knight Rises. It's a bit like that. But, you know, I wonder whether that's fertile ground.
It's tough, right? Because part of me thinks, having seen, again, the second time I saw it, I actually thought differently of the ending. Because the first time I was like, oh, okay, maybe they're doing a No Man's Land thing. But actually, I think the purpose of the flood is metaphorical.
It's biblical.
More than anything. And it's more to say, like, you know, the streets are being washed clean in a literal sense.
I agree, but also I'm going to predict that we, in 18 months, new story just in, the Batman 2 will be called The Batman, No Man's Land. you could see it, right?
Maybe. Is the scale of the destruction at the end of this movie, it's hard to look at it and think anything more than, how do they get a city back from this? Like, the whole thing is
heatwave.
What, like 40 feet underwater? And also, how many people must have died? Also, why did you build a city with a seawall holding back? Part of me wonders also if maybe the reason it got so badly flooded is just because it's raining all the time.
Yes. it was already such a base level.
But, you know, as in a metaphorical sense, I kind of liked the imagery of having the flood and having them on top of the Gotham Square Garden at the end. Partially, I think the purpose of that sequence was to, like, it was justifiable. It wasn't just a, let's do something that's a big spectacle at the end. It was kind of, we need Robert Pattinson's Batman to understand that...
To get wet. Go for a little swim.
To understand that he's not just, like, a, you know, blunt weapon against crime. Like, he actually has to do more and has to be a hero. And, like, there's that brilliant image of him, like, sort of waist deep in the water with a flare, like, leading people out of the darkness and out of danger. And that, for me, is, like, that's the takeaway statement about the character in this, is like, oh, this is a Batman who isn't making himself the enemy of people to try and, you know, draw fire towards himself because he's got a death wish. Like, he's someone who has the power and the resources to help and therefore is going to. Like, it was such, for me, it was a real good statement about the character that takes, you know, the Nolan and Snyder views of, like, this sort of tortured, twisted guy who just wants to, you know, beat the guy who killed his parents but can't, and makes it into something a bit more classically heroic and more recognizably Batman for me.
Interesting. I wonder whether the movie starts with the kind of Nolan setup, if you will, you know, all that all that dialogue at the beginning after the Riddler prologue, I guess it's a prologue, you know, where he's like, fear is a tool, and, you know, the bit with the guy gets hit by the car because he's looking I love that, but he's looking to the alley and sort of he's just imagining that Batman is there in the alley.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole,
I really, you know, like that sequence. Signal. I thought that sequence was great.
But perhaps, James, what you're saying is that is part of Batman. Yes, but maybe the kind of previous version, the Nolan version, is that's the dominant concept. Whereas actually, by the end of this movie, there's that still, but then there's also Batman as a visible kind of hero leader, you know, to the public.
And also, like, it's sort of on the nose. It's on the nose how they do it, where they have their sort of Riddler, you know, acolyte say, I'm vengeance. And, like, you get the shot of him almost literally realizing, like, oh, like, anyone who goes around saying they're vengeance is probably nuts. Maybe I shouldn't just define myself by that one thing.
I didn't like that. I didn't like the vengeance thing. I thought that was a way of, not to scat around, but like, I don't know whether that was a way of, because I didn't want him to say I'm Batman, because that felt like a too recent a thing. So he calls himself a different thing and it's the word vengeance. I don't get it.
He only says I'm vengeance once in the movie, and then everyone else is going like, oh, it's Mr. Vengeance over there. It's like, does he just go around saying that to everyone?
but also it's not like it's not like it's one of those movies where I'm trying to think of an example that I can't right now, where, you know, it's only at the end of the origin story movie that the character name kind of gets said, right? In the world, in the movie, he is Batman, or the Batman, or whatever. He is called that.
Yeah.
But then characters refer to him as Vengeance, and he refers to himself as Vengeance, and very few characters seem to refer to him as Batman. You know, I know the Riddler writes to the Batman on his letter.
I didn't say this at all. I thought he was he was saying, vengeance is my business, basically. And that was striking fear. And that, yeah, he was called Batman. And everyone was calling him Batman. What do we think of Robert Pattinson?
Good.
He's good. I was surprised by how sort of straight down the line it was. I was expecting something a bit bolder, but actually...
It is straight down the line. But it was what I was saying about... I think Pattinson has shown us enough in his other performances that you're like... That there is the, and I think this is a great eye performance. Like, I think he does great eye work. Like,
doesn't have much choice, does it?
But if other Batmen have done good chin work, I think he does great eye work. And especially, you know, when he takes off the mask and the kind of the gothy Robert Smith eyes. And but I just think like there is this kind of, and when he doesn't have the mask on as well, there is this sense of like, I'm sure that there are a couple of points in the movie where people who have already encountered him. I think that it was the bit at the funeral. I thought that this was the case.
Gordon.
The funeral with Gordon and
with the boy
and the kid.
Yeah.
Well, no, but with Falcone and the kid and but there was a few.
Yeah, the boy knows. The boy.
There was a few different people that looked at him and I just thought it was like it was this kind of like. This just like world weary heaviness behind the eyes that was the same whether he was Batman or Bruce Wayne. And at the end as well, when he knocks on the door of Falcone's club as Bruce Wayne, and I'd like those twins on the door felt like that they were kind of like, okay, why does this feel weird? because I think he has that, like I said at the start, moroseness. He has this morose intensity to him that I think really works and works as a like as a very specific take on the character. But I like that it is just kind of like really consistent, and you can see him sometimes trying to fight against it and maybe show a bit more or be a bit more, and he can't quite do it.
I also think, you know, he hasn't led a major film since the Twilight movies, really, a major Hollywood film, I want to say, I think. And those films are wrapped up in all their own stuff, and I think he, you know, you can watch those now and you can. Just in that, on that really deep, the sort of not deep, actually, really surface level or instinctive level, where the performer appears on screen, and is your eye drawn to them? Are you interested in what they are doing on camera and in the scene? And I think that doesn't necessarily, you know, doesn't necessarily hit all the way through those four movies. But you watch this, and he is compelling, and your eyes are drawn to him, and he's just got that movie star thing. And I think that's. I agree with you, Joe, about the depth of the performance and, you know, his take on it. I agree with all that. But also, I think it's good because he's got that thing, you know, not everybody has, very few people have. And he can carry, you know, both when he's in a suit, a shirt and tie and normal civilian clothing, but also kind of fascinatingly when he's in the bat suit, even maybe more so, he just carries your attention for 3 hours, and that's very few people can do that, and he does that in this, I think. And,
I think probably part of what makes that version of the character work is that he is sort of impenetrable. Like, you really want to know what's going on under the surface. He's sort of giving nothing away in that sense. Like, you get the only bits where he really feels honest is when he's with Alfred. And you can see that he's sort of angry and, you know, emotionally bruised. Or later on, like, scared. But the rest of the movie, it's really hard to tell what's going on in his mind.
My only criticism of the performance, and we can get to it, is, and maybe this is my own expectation because I'd read the Tom King comics, but I just wanted more from the relationship, romantic dynamic between him and Catwoman.
So I think that those two are great together. I think Zoe Kravitz is really good. I just think it's something that this movie doesn't have, ironically, enough time to devote to, and it doesn't want to go that far, because this version of the Batman isn't kind of emotionally ready to open up yet. So I could see a future where you're getting that delivered, Reese. But I thought it was great how it it was like under the surface sexy. Like, I think my favorite moment in the film is when
putting in the contact lens, that bit?
No, it's when Selina has broken into the mayor's house to rob the safe, and then the security guard or whatever comes up, or the cop comes up, and they have to hide. And they hide around the corner, and Batman kind of pulls her in close to him and has his, like, you know, his hands across her chest holding her down. And they're both breathing really heavily while trying to keep quiet. And then they start breathing in rhythm. And it is this really intimate kind of, like, unbroken 10-20-second shot of the two of them just, you know, as close as they can be, breathing, like, in perfect rhythm, like two people fucking would. And and I thought it was this really great, intense moment for two actors who I thought had chemistry throughout the film. It just didn't go as far with it as Reese, I can imagine you wanted it to go.
I wanted them to kiss more, do more of the kissing.
They did kiss like twice though, I think.
Well, I think it's just the once, isn't it?
I think we got two kisses.
Anyway, whatever. If it's one or two, I want it to be 100 or 200. You know, that's where I am on the kissing.
It's funny. I've never been bowled over by Zoe Kravitz, but I watched this and Kimmy within like a fortnight of each other, and thought she was like super great in both of those. So maybe I need to go back and reassess. Maybe I need to watch that High Fidelity series,
which people fucking love, by the way.
Yeah,
people love that show. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, obviously she is preternaturally beautiful and has like these insane genetics with her parents that have led to that. But I think this is a really robust performance for a character who doesn't have that much going on, but I think she brings enough to it. Like, she has a. You know, she has a clear subplot, which is her friend has been killed, and she is vengeance too, right? that's part of his journey. Is like, if he can stop her becoming vengeance, then maybe he can learn that he shouldn't be it as well. See, Reese, it all keeps coming back, this vengeance stuff.
God damn it! This movie's deep as hell. Wow, these guys are so smart. Wrote it. I love it.
But yeah, I thought she was really good.
How does she know how to fight so good?
What do you mean?
She's Catwoman, man.
I just thought it was like, he can do he's fighting and he's doing all the fights and he's got a suit, and then all of a sudden she's like, wah, 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 doing all the karate stuff.
She isn't as skilled as him, because she does get overpowered by Carmine. And I thought that this was kind of a, like,
origin?
Like a comment on someone who has had to live on the bottom, live at the bottom, and has had to figure out ways to stay alive, and that she has sometimes done that with her sexuality, and sometimes done it.
Sometimes
with,
learned kung fu,
and learned how to protect herself.
I mean, even asking that question is some fucking Nolan shit. Like, how does she fight? It's a superhero movie. That's the genre. Like, the fighting is a metaphor. Okay.
Hold on. Hey, listen.
Trained by fucking monks. We're on is the that same what you
side.
Hear?
We're on the same side. I hear you. But, you know, also what you don't have with her character is a kind of a mad Halle Berry or Michelle Pfeiffer costume. You know, there's a grounded element, especially with her, to the look. And so you've got to be, I think, as filmmakers of these movies, that's that line you have to kind of carefully tread, right? Where the more grounded you make them, which was what Nolan did, then that leaves, I think it's okay for an audience to be like, oh, okay, I guess this is the real world. But if it's the real world, question one, question two, question three. And, you know, there are times when this movie is, well, the whole movie is very stylized, but I'm just saying I did have, you know, she doesn't sort of have a proper superhero costume. She's got that little bandana thing, which has some slight points
slight
in the ears.
Yeah.
But I'm not gonna apologize, Mr. Hunt, for just therefore thinking, oh, this character is styled and sort of portrayed as a quote unquote normal person, and so how can she do those kicks? I'm not apologizing for that. I'm not.
I just think be guided by the aesthetics rather than the practicalities.
I did want her to get a better mask by the end of the movie.
Perhaps a pair of goggles that you can turn upwards onto your head and it looks like cat ears. Maybe that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
I did like that this felt like a return to the more Burton-y, like we're not going to try and pretend this is a real city. We are, you know, it needs to function as a city, but it's like it doesn't make sense in a real world. It's kind of like its own little comic book universe where, yes, there is a Bloodhaven up the road, but this is Gotham and that's all you need to know. All you need to know is what's happening in Gotham. Forget about the other stuff. And I liked that there was that lack of trying to, yeah, explain the entire world to you and how everything worked and why this character would be wearing goggles that made her look like it, you know, made it look like ears. I liked all that stuff a lot more. There was an intention to Gotham.
However, but it's not, you know, it's for all of the Snyder bashing, it's not, it doesn't have the heightened sense of those movies. It doesn't even look like, you know, Birds of Prey. I'm thinking of that movie. You almost feel like you're in the Gotham. I think that movie's saying Gotham. You're in the Gotham that Harley Quinn sees. You know, it's a very, you're in her head for that movie. I go back to, you're right. It's a bit more like shoot like before, but it is still quite grounded. For me, my experience watching this was quite grounded. You know, the Batmobile is sort of just there's a sort of muscle car with a thing on the back, and Batman is his costume is, you know, the thing with the sort of sword plate that maybe is a melted down gun that killed his parents or whatever in his chest. Like,
I liked that they didn't explicitly go into that, by the way.
Yeah, I told that.
Yeah.
Didn't need that explaining to me. I'd forgotten that until he unclipped it and I was like, oh, I remember when we talked about that.
And we have to assume that that is exactly what it was always rumored to be.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Say it in the movie.
Definitely. He's the kind of goth that would do that. Let's talk about the Riddler last, because I think he's the kind of most disconnected element. Jeffrey Wright, I thought, was fine, kind of functional for all of his screen time, you know?
I mean, the thing is, he's Jeffrey Wright, and he's so magnetic and brilliant with nothing. So I really liked him and his interactions with Bruce. Like, just the little sort of powwows they kept having, the little chats where, you know, the sequence where he's like, you know, you're acting like a dickhead, but I need to get you out of here, so I'm going to be nice. Like, just the uncorruptibility of that character and the trust they had between them.
Yeah, but
I think need someone like Jeffrey Wright to sell.
But that. It's off the shelf shit, and Jeffrey Wright's doing off the shelf Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah,
and
that's
right. Yeah, but it's still great.
We've seen this. We've seen it.
I don't have anything negative to say about it, but I feel like you could pop that. You know, you could pop that Jeffrey Wright Gordon into the Nolan movies, and it not feel hugely different. That's fair. Because you know, I think Gary Oldman's doing a solid job in those as well.
Why are you laughing? He is doing a solid job. he's good in those. Don't you dare.
Who
don't
else?
Don't you dare. He's good.
Solid.
He fakes his death and his wife slaps him. She's so upset. Yes, I did watch The Dark Knight last week, so it's in my mind.
We've got Andy Serkis as Alfred Pennyworth.
that is the one performance where I was just like, I'm not buying this, even slightly.
I did like, past and hopefully future guest Sam Clements tweeted something about, like, with Andy Serkis in The Batman, I really hope that this means that Matt Reeves will be playing Venom's butler in the next Venom movie.
Venom. That's a good tweet.
When I saw it with Anna, she was like, he feels like he's about to try and sell you some fucking bootleg vibranium or something.
I didn't mind him. I thought that this movie didn't really feel like it needed Alfred. And actually, when they did the Alfred nearly dying scene, I was like, I guess it kind of makes sense that he would be dead already. That he would die in the first movie. That would make sense. And then they didn't do it. And I thought that that was certainly the way that that sequence was staged. I think that's the messiest part plot-wise in the movie.
A bomb blows up in his face and he's alive.
A bomb blows up in his face and he's alive. B, I'm not sure why he needed to still be alive other than
he's Alfred.
Alfred. And then the whole stuff with the Riddler picking off people and being very, very deliberate and like not giving anyone any wiggle room that they could survive these situations, apart from Bruce Wayne, so that there can be some kind of like, so there can be a twist at the end where we think he knows that Bruce Wayne is Batman, but actually he doesn't. Then, well, okay, so then that doesn't make sense why he didn't just kill Bruce rather than.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean,
all the other characters are in like.
Sending a package to his house that probably wouldn't have killed him anyway. Exactly. And then just going, like, didn't work. I'll just carry on with the rest of my schemes.
Yeah, we put him in a suit and rats will eat his body, or like, we've constructed an elaborate game and he's in like a Chinese finger trap, or like, versus, we'll send him a bomb in the post. I guess. So hope he opens
just an afterthought, yeah.
This must be opened by this person, what I am trying to kill.
I did like the intercutting of that sequence where he's gotten back and it's sort of the bomb's already gone off. I liked that, but then
I thought that it felt weird to then undermine that by being like, and there he is in hospital. Like, what? what do you mean there he is in hospital?
Did you guys read that? I feel like I read a headline, maybe it's on CBR.com, saying that. There's a cut, you know, an earlier version of the movie, not the script, but the movie, it has him dying in that sequence, which, if true, would make sense.
I mean, I can sort of understand, like, why they didn't do that, because it's the kind of thing where if Batman's surrogate father dies before he's had a chance to reconcile his, you know, feelings towards that character... it just always feels like a loss. Like you can't win the movie if Alfred dies under those circumstances. And sort of like the reason that relationship with Alfred is there is to show you Bruce Wayne sort of coming to terms with, you know, his sort of personal feelings towards other people. And his realization that vengeance isn't the only thing that he can live for.
Yeah, although Catwoman can act in that.
but if
we presume that Alfred might have been killed in this movie, I think Catwoman can act as that.
Yeah,
but it feels less specifically like sexual if it's Alfred as well.
Well,
no, he wants to fuck Alfred for sure.
I think this is one of those examples of a comic book movie feeling like it has to have a certain thing or do a certain thing, and it being to the film's detriment. Because if this wasn't a Batman movie, the Alfred character wouldn't need to exist. It would make sense that you've got this loner in a mansion. And actually, maybe you could have done something slightly more interesting with Carmine, that, you know, that
he was the surrogate father, yeah.
Yeah, that there was more of an explicit relationship there, and that Bruce mm-hmm. always held back slightly, you know, when it came to Carmine versus everyone else, because Carmine helped out his dad back in the day, and his, you know, and then instead we get two exposition dumps, one from Carmine and one from
Alfred,
and you're like, well, did we? Again, all of that felt at that point in the movie a bit clumsy in terms of the way that it had been seeded out. I did like what it was doing thematically with Thomas Wayne to go, look, dude wasn't necessarily a bad guy, but even the good guys make mistakes sometimes, and he made a mistake that, you know, was very huge and costly to him. But actually, also, weirdly, the biggest mistake he made was the one that he thought was, you know, like, his greatest benevolence. Like, he set up the criminals in Gotham for life without realizing it. And I did like that as well, that there could be this, you know, sometimes even the best intentions, you know, in a corrupt system will still fall on deaf ears. And I liked that within it.
Should I tell you what I liked about that? Is that it answers the question of why doesn't Bruce Wayne give all his money to charity?
Yes. I wonder if that was specifically why it was there.
Because his dad did, and it made the Riddler.
It's not going to stop the tweets going round every 6 months, but I appreciate
the tweets or the tweets? Do you say the tweets?
The tweets. You know, the tweet about, like, why is Batman beating up the mentally ill instead of donating his money to charity? This is why.
Right.
Because if he donated it to charity, it would get stolen by the mob.
What a wonderful world we live in.
Okay. Another slightly, I don't know, a slightly odd presence in this movie is Colin Farrell's Penguin.
Yes! He's fun!
He's fun, but he kind of, like, he exists off to the side. He's kind of like the first face of the Gotham underworld that we meet. And it's not for a while that we realize that actually he's one of the smaller fry rather than the big dude. It's not for a while that you would realize that that's Colin Farrell if you didn't know that the casting was there.
I don't think
not
at any all. Point. Yeah.
There was a couple of times when he said something where I was like, oh, I can kind of, or like maybe certain ways that his face would contort, and I was like, oh yeah, that I can kind of see Colin Farrell under there for a split second. But yeah, this felt like, I don't know, this feels weird to me because you are kind of spending a movie where there isn't any massive integral function for the Penguin to play in this. So you're spending a movie kind of depicting the next big crime guy. But ultimately, we know he's the Penguin, and even if the Penguin is a big Batman villain, he's never going to be the coolest Batman villain, and you're not going to be kind of like scared of what the Penguin's going to become.
Well, I mean, a counterpoint to that is that, you know, I think what this movie, I think that, again, it's a bit of a needle thread, but, you know, Colin Farrell is in this. He's fun in the role. The role is small. He does what he does. But I kind of, you know, I think that he is being set up as a sort of a proper villain for the, you know, for maybe the show and then a couple of movies hence. And you've got a great, you know, you've got a great actor in a kind of a compelling, you know, he's funny. You are drawn to him in this film, I think. And so you've got a good foundation. You just need to give him something to do. And you know, there's lots of great Penguin stories in the comics where the Penguin is, you know, the Danny DeVito Penguin looms so large across any depiction of the Penguin or any Penguin story. But actually, there's loads of good stories about the Penguin, where he's a proper threat and properly a dark character and a proper kind of counterpart villain to Batman that we haven't really seen in the movie. We definitely haven't seen the movies or the TV shows. That I think you've got the foundation from this film to kind of to go into.
The DeVito Penguin is kind of like
an aberration. A bit,
well, it's
right?
It's like the 60s Batman meshed with this Tim Burton aesthetic. Like that that character doesn't really exist in that form in the comics.
Mm.
Like he's more of a crime boss. And I think is it Long Halloween that makes quite a lot of him as a crime boss, maybe?
I mean, I have encountered him in other places and obviously in the games as well. But I don't know, you're gonna have to do a real good job to get me like super excited about the Penguin as a major figure. I liked him in that first kind of scene in the nightclub. And I thought he became very functional after that. And I do just find the whole Colin Farrell casting to put him in that costume, in that, I'm assuming it's makeup. I find it strange. And his performance, like, I love Colin Farrell. I normally am so in the tank for him. I thought that the longer this film came on, it became like a De Niro in The Untouchables riff. Like, and I mean, that's quite a hammy performance from De Niro. And this I think is more so because it's an Irish guy, you know, putting on that accent. I remain unsold on Penguin moving forward. Oz, the great and powerful Oz.
I'd be if not for Farrell. That's the only thing that I think, you know, Colin Farrell has turned into a really interesting actor who makes really interesting choices. And I kind of think him and Matt Reeves have had some chat in the last few years and he's gone like, this is why I want you for this. This is the plan. Are you down? And Farrell's gone, yes. And yeah, it's just the Farrell piece. If it was any other actor or you know, a lesser actor, I'd think, yes, what a bit of a waste, or like hire a fat guy or whatever, you know, but Colin Farrell's good and he's, you know, I'm excited.
I sort of think the reason you need a character like that is just to pad out the sort of structure of Gotham, but in a way that, like, if the Penguin shows up in a Batman film, you're not thinking maybe he's a good guy. Like you know that he is bad, and that's a useful component of a story when you're using a shared library of characters.
I don't think Colin Farrell signs up to pad out the villain.
No, but in this,
I think he's doing something else.
In this movie, I think it's useful to have like an underboss who you know is who you know is a bad guy and can't be trusted, and then you have the sort of tension of him, you know, sitting in a room with Batman having a chat, and Bruce Wayne's trying desperately not to break the law and not get killed, and you know, Penguin sitting there dealing drugs. Like it is a really integral part of the texture of Gotham and of the criminal underworld generally. And I think you're right that there's more to come for the character, but I think even if there wasn't, you know, it's all valid in this movie.
So the version of this that I liked was John Turturro. and no one was more shocked than me that I liked the John Turturro Carmine, because I didn't know he was in this. I'd forgotten or didn't know. And I was like, oh, I wonder who's playing Carmine. You kind of got a glimpse of him in the club when Selena talks to him in the club and you see him for the first time. Yeah. I was like, who is that? And then I was like, was that John Turturro? And then at the funeral, you're like, oh, it is John Turturro. And I always think that he is such a risky bit of casting in dramatic roles. Well, not always, actually. He has become a risky bit of casting in dramatic roles because of his comedic work in the years in between. And I think that if
because of the Transformers movies.
Yes, the Transformers. Yeah, the Coen Brothers stuff. I mean, obviously, his seminal work in You Don't Mess With the Zohan. And I'm not being sarcastic. But yeah, I always think he's like, there is just something about his persona now that I'm like, oh, if you miss slightly, you really miss. And I just thought he got this.
Yeah,
I thought he got this right, and he felt dangerous, but he also felt like he had that kind of like, you could see like the scene where Bruce comes to see him. You could see him kind of like falling under his spell slightly, and when he told the story to Bruce, I was like, yeah, maybe that's how it went down. I kind of like for a scene, I bought it until Andy Serkis re-explained it to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought
this is one of those.
It's really good, and he looks good in those suits. See that he really, really that those suits and those shades. He really makes it work.
This is one of those like performances where I thought, oh, have we been missing, you know, great John Turturro villain performances for the past whatever 20 years? Because he's so threatening, but he's sort of soulful. Yeah, he plays his angles amazingly. He was excellent. He was so good.
A lot of charisma.
Wow.
Okay, so 100%. I'm just working my way down the cast list. The final big one that we need to talk about is Paul Dano as Riddler.
Mm. Mm.
I am sorry to say, I thought he was bad.
I don't know if I thought he was bad. There were certainly bits of the performance where I was going, I'm not sure about this, because there are things about that
really,
character.
Really, Jay?
Like even I,
he does that like, weird thing where he draws out weird words in his sentences.
Like I got real non-specifically mentally ill vibes from him in a way that I didn't like in Joker and I didn't like in this.
I think he was more incel coded than mentally ill, personally.
Yeah, I landed on that later, but like
I get obsessed with how does he make that question mark in the coffee? It's so perfect. He's got so little
that
time.
Shot is so dumb. Why do they do that? Why does Matt Reeves do that? Why and like and Giacchino's score is like okay.
Especially because
maybe ask the barista to do it. I don't know.
That scene where he's like where he gets arrested and they're like slamming him on the counter and he's like grinning and happy that it's happening. Like I found that one of the more chilling aspects of his performance. Cause like that's such a weird thing where he's getting this like weird orgasmic pleasure out of being arrested. You don't need the cartoon coffee as well.
You know what Batman should, you know what Jeffrey Wright should have said in that scene where they get the, he should have said, I drink your latte, I drink it up. That's what should have happened in that moment.
I don't understand what he thought, that what Reeves thought that shot was going to do for an audience. Like, oh my God.
It's in the trailer though.
Latte art. Is that,
I think, is that also, who does latte art? Who does latte latte? Oh, I'm sorry, you've northern short circuit in my brain. Who does latte arts in like an American like skeevy diner? Yeah. Why would that even be like a latte art?
Why would you order that unless you just like to draw the question marks?
I think, I mean, it's the trailer shot. I honestly think
in the trailer
it's
too.
Just there to be in the trailer.
You don't need to put it in the movie. You can just go, great, we got our trailer shot. Let's not put it in there.
Yes. Cut it. It stinks. Cut it.
So again, I feel I should point out, I really like Paul Dano in a lot of stuff that he's done. I find him like a really reliable presence / very, very good sometimes. I just don't think I was very interested in the Riddler, like conceptually, like it just as a nondescript serial killer, fine. And I thought, you know, like some of the as a villain who is leaving clues for the Batman to solve, that works. But anytime he's actually, you know, like physically present. I really didn't like all of the video stuff because it felt really derivative of
Heath Ledger
in that really iconic scene in The Dark Knight, mm-hmm. and also with the mm-hmm. voice tics of Tom Hardy.
Yep.
The
mask, you know, it's just too. This is the my original point about this, there's not enough fresh about this movie. I think he is the worst. He's the biggest example of that.
Yeah. And
where you're doing the Riddler and you've already done the Riddler. Jim Carrey, you know, for good or ill, kind of put a stamp on that character cinematically. So you're doing it again, fine. Paul Dano, fine. But I think my fear going into it was, well, is it just going to be like sort of creepy Paul Dano doing a Heath Ledger thing? And like, that is what it is. And it's nothing more than that. It's maybe even less than that. And you could have, there's so many frigging Batman villains. I don't know. There's so many. Why him? Why like, this casting? Why this performance? Why this?
I don't need a third act twist. I don't need that stuff in every one of these movies. But if you're doing the Riddler, I kind of feel like there needs to be something unexpected about him. And the Riddler we meet is the most expected version of the Riddler there could be. Especially unless you keep the casting secret. You try and like intentionally wrong foot us and make us think that he is this, you know, more Jim Carrey-esque version of the character. And it turns out he's just this incel fuck. But yeah, I think he swings for the fences and all the Ave Maria stuff, like, for, you know, fair play. fair play for giving that a crack. But I should say as well, like I mentioned Giacchino's score in the diner, he weaves Ave Maria into it from the early sequences, and I think it's a great score from Giacchino, who I wouldn't have thought was a brilliant fit for this. But I think this is better than anything he's done over on the Marvel side.
Even I was watching this movie going, "Oh, the score on this is great."
Really atmospheric. So,
but also, the score is also in a lot of it. It's a lot of score.
Yes.
Yeah, it's got this kind of constant sort of undercurrent, this like throb to it that I really liked. And also, just while we're on the subject of music, this is how you use a Nirvana song in a superhero movie, Black Widow.
But it still works. Still works in Black Widow.
No.
It does. Yes.
No.
Yes.
No. Next question.
Don't they use that film like three times? That Nirvana song like three times in the movie?
They do.
I think twice.
Okay, twice. It's still criminal.
But also, that you know, the score is, in terms of like music you hear, you've got that thumping theme, Batman theme, which my friend pointed out, who I saw it with, well, Sam, my housemate, previously mentioned on this show, pointed out is just the Star Wars theme with one note removed, right? It's the Vader theme. Da 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 da. It's not that. It's da 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 da. It's the anyway. Fine.
I've not got deep into it yet. You need Amon on the episode to confirm or deny this.
Listen to both those again. It's one of those kind of like, oh, he's picked, because I think you hear the. I listened to the theme before the movie came out, and sort of it just sounds both familiar, very familiar, but imposing and fresh and threatening, and it's a magic trick by Jake, you know. He's just honestly picked fucking two notes and. But it's the right two notes, you know? anyway, so you get that theme, you get the Nirvana song, and there's a kind of a bit of a, there's quite a different Catwoman theme, I think, you know, the sort of much higher up in the range. But you don't really hear much other music other than those kind of three melodies, which I thought was quite, across a 3-hour movie, that was quite, that was a choice. The range of the soundtrack and the score is kind of limited in a good way, in an interesting way.
You got too specific on the score for me there, Reece. All I know is I liked it. I'll report back when I've listened to more on Spotify or whatever.
I'll send you the Star Wars link and then the Batman link, because it's the same. He's taken a note out. He's removed a bit of the song.
Okay,
but it works.
I believe you. Just the last piece of casting I want to mention. Wild that Trevor from EastEnders is the head of the Gotham PD. So if you guys remember Trevor from EastEnders, Alex Ferns. Nope. So all of my British soap opera knowledge comes from when I was like between the ages of like 7 and 12, when I'm old enough to remember it, but not old enough to be able to leave the house and not watch it when my parents are watching it. Yeah. So I've got this like very specific like late 90s to early 2000s frame of reference for British soap operas. And Trevor was this Irish guy who was beating up Little Mo. He was a wrong'un, but he was this gorgeous Irish guy with these piercing blue eyes. And he turns up here as the like bedraggled head of the Gotham PD. And I was shook, as the kids say. So I just thought I would shout him out as well. Sarsgaard comes in as the DA. I don't remember him being in it.
He was so good.
He's good fun for those sequences, right?
I really like the way he plays it, which is like this just fucking clueless.
Pathetic. Yeah. He's pathetic.
Yeah, like it's such a unique performance considering the rest of the... Like everyone else is so grizzled and he's like, oh yeah, yeah, do you wanna come back to my place?
He's this like glassy-eyed sap because he's been taking the shitty drugs another angle on corruption of just, and when he reveals the amount they were paying him as well, you're like, fuck, really? Was that it?
I loved when Catwoman meets him in the club and then Bruce says, oh, he's high. I just thought he played sort of boringly high so well. Like, yeah. This wasn't like slow-mo in the club, like he just rambling
and
out of it. It was like I've met guys on coke in bars that it was that performance. I relate.
Like, dude, this has nothing to do with the circumstances. I just don't want to be around you. Okay, I want to talk about detecting.
Yeah, me too.
So let me. Can I reveal a story from my screening of the Batman? I didn't fall asleep. So I went to see the Batman at my local Showcase Cinema, which is one of those very nice cinemas with the reclining leather seats and whatnot.
It's a northern chain, I believe.
Is it exclusively northern?
I used to go to a Showcase in Coventry, and that is the Midlands, which is not in the north.
That's northern enough. Yeah. North of me.
That is a London centric view.
I also as
a Midlands erasure.
Yes, I am a. I am a northerner who currently lives in the Midlands. So anyway, definitely a Midlands chain. It's in the north as well. And so I'm laid back in my nice reclining seats. And at some point, like around like an hour or so into the movie, I'm sure I hear something drop to the ground. And I'm like, oh, what's happened there? Is something falling out of my pockets? So I'm checking in my pockets and I'm like, okay, my car keys are there, my wallet's there, my phone's there, my AirPods are there. Okay, that's everything. I'm fine. But then what was that that dropped out of my pocket? And I'm like, okay, well, never mind. It's niggling at me, guys. It's niggling at me. And I'm like, how could I put my hands back in my pockets? Like, did I really detect all those things? Yeah, that's my wallet. Yeah, it's okay. No. Okay. So then we're about 2 hours into the movie and I go, house keys. You also had your house keys because obviously you need to take your house keys out. So maybe it was those. So I'm going like, okay. So it's very likely that my house keys have fallen out of my pocket and that they have fallen through the crack in the chair and are on the floor. Okay, this is okay. I've successfully.
Where's the story going?
I've done my investigation. They are.
That's a detective riff. Okay.
Yeah, they're on the floor. They're on the floor, right?
Okay. Yeah,
anyway, right. So the film ends, and I get out my phone, and like a twat, I have to get down on my hands and knees, turn on the torch on my phone, and I'm like looking under the seat, and I can't see them, and I'm like I can't just, and it's late. I'd like it's a 3 hour fucking screening. I need to get home. I need to get to sleep, and I'm just like, do I take the risk that I was wrong and I didn't drop them? And then I decide, right, okay, seat goes down. I'll go back to the car, and if the if the house keys are in the car, then that's fine. That they're always in the car. Anyway, I get back to the car and I look, and the house keys aren't there, and I'm like, for fuck's sake! And I pick up my, so I go to put my jacket back on and put my hands in my jacket pocket, and they're in there. So anyway,
okay, we'll cut that.
So also
that story was longer than the movie.
But what I'm trying to say is ultimately I solved it despite showing utter incompetence at every turn along the way. Every time I thought I was onto something, I wasn't. Like every time I thought, is that? So did anything fall on the floor? I don't know. Maybe I left something there that I had no idea that I took with me. But is that any worse than going, pigeon, a falcon, a bat, what?
A larder, right?
Are there any other animals left? A penguin? What are we doing? We're just throwing out the names of anything with wings at this point, guys. Bruce Wayne is such a fucking incompetent detective in this movie.
This is the thing, right? I remember when they announced this movie, I remember saying how like the thing I've never seen on screen is a detective Batman, and how I really wanted that to be the vibe. And on one level, I'm so happy that they did a detective story. On the other, I'm like, if you're sitting in the cinema going, a rat with wings is a bat, you fucking morons. Like, it's immediately obvious. It is unbelievable that they go anywhere else first.
But the fact that they go through four different...
Yeah. The thing I like is that sequence where they kidnap the penguin and they interrogate him, and he's like, you guys are fucking idiots. Like...
Hey guys, I'm from New York City, and I got my voice. And what have you guys done about the Batman? Is this thing a lot of running?
Batman? Even I know this is a year two Batman, and the idea is like, you know,
he's kind of dumb stuff.
He screws up some stuff. You know, he flunks his landing when he has the wingsuit.
His detecting is consistently poor.
Yeah, and even Jim Gordon is a career detective, and even he can't figure this stuff out.
And then it
would have been good if you'd have done like a. When the penguin reveals that thing about the Batman, then Batman sort of does a like face palm, and then you would get the Kirby Enthusiasm music. Boom, 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 ba-da,
I like that. Like almost like there are so many points in the movie where there are riddles being read out, and Batman's just like, got it straight away. Boom, got it. It's that.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you with that whole. That whole rat with wings thing in the middle. That I just could not stop thinking about that scene from Batman 66 where they're solving the riddle. It's like, well, it's clearly a banana fountain pen or something like that. And I'm like, shit, maybe all he needed was Burt Ward, and this would have been solved. Because like anyone that tries to hand it is fucking incompetent. Like at the start when Batman's like, oh yeah, he's left his first cipher. And Andy Serkis is like, right, okay. So I'm going to have a look at this, and I've done ciphers before, Master Wayne, and I've done this, and I've taken out these letters. And he's like, why the fuck have you taken out those letters? Put them back in, you fucking idiot. and then we'll solve it. It's like I was such a bizarre kind of like setup for that scene to go like why like. Why would you have Alfred helping out only to be proved immediately wrong?
I think part of the point is Alfred has to look dumb so that Bruce Wayne can look smart. Like, that's the only reason I can think he's doing that.
The whole thing has Bruce, a whiff
like,
of...
Alfred helps out a couple of times, and every time he does it, he screws it up until eventually he gets blown up at the end.
It has the whiff of the Studio 60 problem with it, I think, where, you know, that show was like, yeah, this is the greatest sketcher of all time, and these sketches are incredibly incredible hilarious. And then you watch the sketch, it's like, oh, this is a musical number about how George Bush is like, yeah, sort of has a stinky armpit. Like, this is so
or
lame.
Like Marvelous, this is like Marvelous Miss Maisel, right?
Miss Maisel,
yeah,
exactly,
where
right?
It's about comedy, but her routines aren't funny.
So,
yeah.
So in this case, you've opened up the Batman is the world's greatest detective, you know, box, and then you have to kind of fulfill that in the movie. Does it a few times at the beginning and then whiffs.
But it sticks in behind the eight ball so much that, like, I don't know, like, So he has to be in this movie one step behind the Riddler the whole time. But it just makes him look shit at his job. And you know, there's a point towards the end of the movie where, like, he's explicit about it. He's like, I know I'm doing exactly what the Riddler wants me to do, but that's the only way to end this now. And it's like, yeah, but that's how you've been doing stuff the whole way. You've literally been, like, he has been planning out his traps for you, and you've been going
bumbling into them.
No, just compliantly going, okay, and yeah, I'll play this game. And that's what I mean about, like, all of that side of things. I just found there was like an undercurrent of frustration with that throughout. Like, I liked the idea of Batman leaning on being a detective, and I liked him recording everything, and I liked his journals, and, like, the, you know, that this was a project.
Dear diary, I did a punch on a villain.
Lego Batman vibes there, definitely. But yeah,
the problem is you have that middle. I think this is all tying together with when I watched it first and got drunk and fell asleep. Like, you know, you had that middle hour is, you know, I'm actually going to say that my drunkenly falling asleep was my review. You know, you and this is tying into what you've been saying, Joe, but, you know, that middle chunk, I think it the story doesn't move along quick enough. Even with the slow pace that the movie has already set in its first hour, which I'm with. And that ties in with the detective story. Then you get to the El Dorado or whatever crap thing, you know, that you just could do with a couple of extra steps on that path. Whereas instead he gets caught up, or him and Gordon get caught up on that one thing, and there's no progression. And as you say, he just kind of picks a couple of different birds. It just feels like a sort of low hanging fruit that they, why couldn't they have just figured out a different, you know, an evolution of the plot beat in that middle hour, just to move things along? I don't really get it.
Or just at one point, maybe to flip it and see kind of the Riddler on his heels, that Batman's gotten a step ahead. He's gotten a step ahead, and the Riddler has to up his game.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I find really funny is that when he goes to see the Riddler in Arkham, like, he says, like, oh, you know, we're gonna watch the stuff happen. And Batman's like, what stuff? And the Riddler's like, oh, you didn't figure it out. And, like, he's like disappointed that Batman hasn't figured out his riddles.
Because they're going for the Joker thing, aren't they? Like, so much of the thrill of that, of the Dark Knight, is the Joker is steps ahead of Batman, and those schemes are so kind of complex and fascinating and wild, and the audience figures out, you know, at the same rate that Batman does. Like, are they not going for that a bit? But of course, you don't have the Ledger performance, you don't have the core, you know, eternal Smalley dynamic between those two characters. You've replaced it with something that's lesser, plus the performance is lesser. Which also, you know, which makes you think, why did they try and do this in the first place? You know, you're just imitating, you know, it looks like a pale imitation, all of those pieces.
I think there are certainly a couple of moments where it comes off as a pale imitation. I think the final Arkham confrontation feels like that. You just want him to get it. Like I said, the stuff that I liked in the middle act was all of the, you know, the foundation of Gotham's corruption, and Falcone and Sal Moroni, and the history of the Wayne family, and the you know, the kind of the various things that had fucked up Gotham. I was kind of into all that part of the middle hour, but to the point where, like, you know, there would then be moments where, like, Batman would be like, oh, well, this, you know, does this mean we're not going to be able to get that? We, you know, what about the Riddler? And it's like, oh, I guess one serial killer, give a shit. I don't know. Give me the mob stuff. I'm interested in the mob stuff. That's more interesting. Anyway,
can we talk about
Riddles are bad?
The car chase in that middle hour.
Well, yeah, and maybe the action in general. So the two major action sequences are the car chase and the kind of the fight in Gotham Square Gardens at the end. There are smaller, you know, hand-to-hand action sequences, which I thought they were all pretty good. I thought they did a good job of hand-to-hand action. I thought this was the version of Batman that I was worried we were going to see from that first trailer, where he's just like beating criminals to a bloody pulp. Mm. You see, like, there are a couple of moments where that happens in this movie, but it's like depicted as him like slightly crossing the line.
I think broadly it's quite a good version of the character in that he's not fighting just to fight criminals. He has objectives, and if they get in the way or if they try and kill him, then he'll fight back. But he's generally not brutalizing people.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, no quibbles here with this being a PG-13 or whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
People online were getting upset about. Reese, what did you think of the car chase and the action in general?
Well, it woke me up.
Yeah, it was loud. It was a loud Batmobile.
It literally woke me up.
Very orange and black. That sequence.
I thought one of the things we haven't talked about, or at least I haven't talked about, is the it was a really smart choice to film this in to film the kind of Gotham of this in very different, I think, well, very different, you know, different locations, you know, in the Liverpools, the Glasgows, Edinburgh, you know, dingier parts, you know, Elephant and Clark Castle, I think, is a referenced filming point in London that they film this in. I think it definitely gives this Gotham a really different feel cinematically, but also feeling like a real place, which I think is really smart. And then the car chase is a good indication of that. It looks like a highway or motor, you know, it looks like a British motorway. And, you know, we as Brits sort of understand what we're looking at there, but it gives that sequence a different feel to the, I guess the equivalent sequence in The Dark Knight is probably more Batman Begins. It's the first Batmobile. Chase, right? You know, the bit, and you've got
where he's driving like a tank through police barricades. Yeah.
And that, you know, again, if you're equivalent, if you're sort of comparing the two scenes one to one, it makes, I think that it's not so much the car or the style of the chase, because the chases are kind of quite similar. It's the setting that makes those two sequences feel really different. And I think that, you know, we haven't talked also about Wayne Manor, the sort of lovely gothic, strange kind of. Or not even Wayne Manor. It's like, I think that's Wayne Tower, because it's mm-hmm. you see it as a skyscraper within Gotham City. But when you see his rooms and his dining room, it's got all this Gothic architecture in it. Like, I think that's an interesting choice, a small choice, but an interesting choice. All the filming locations, I think, are relevant and big, and you feel them in the movie because, you know, locations like real locations are. They're kind of a cheap special effect in a lot of ways. They you don't have to do a lot of CGI. You just are going to film like Robert Pattinson in like a weird living room with a lot of pointy spiky chairs. And that's going to say something about the Gotham and the Bruce Wayne that you want to portray. But the car chase sequence, was great. And the score plays a part, and Colin Farrell plays a part, and the Batmobile design plays a part. And I thought it was a good sequence, yeah.
I didn't like it.
you scumbag.
I don't know what I could see from a Batmobile reveal at this point to be like, oh, that's exciting. This isn't it. And then the sequence,
it's like an Audi.
I feel like I've seen the tapes on the Batmobile, and like in this movie, particularly when the Batmobile, when it was like, oh, now it's a Batmobile sequence. I was like, oh, I guess. I hadn't really thought about there not being a car though. I just hadn't thought about it.
Yeah. And then, I was a bit like, I guess they need a Batmobile sequence, because it's a Batman movie more than anything.
And then the chase itself, I do get that they were going for something a bit different, and there was lots of low angles, lots of shot from the kind of like the wheels, and we were hopping between stuff. But that's not what I like out of a car chase, what this sequence delivers. And getting not really none of it really from Batman's point of view, or very little. I think it mostly is from the Penguin's POV. But yeah, I just couldn't really see. I couldn't really tell what was going on. I didn't feel like there was any cool driving. And then, like, it's a car chase down a highway. It felt to me like it was masking that Matt Reeves didn't really know how to shoot a compelling car chase. So he just went for a different route in.
So the thing I sort of fall between the two poles here, which is that on the one hand, I always find car chases in movies pretty dull. I think the sole exception to that is in Drive, at the start of Drive, where they do, instead of about speed and danger, it's about tension. Like, that's the only way I've seen a car chase that really worked for me. In this, it just is very loud and very un-Batman-like in that he's, you know, knocking over civilian cars as part of his, you know, lorries are tipping on their sides as part of his chase. It sort of feels like the Batman thing to do would have been to pull out of that because he realized he was causing more damage than he was preventing.
Yeah, I didn't love that.
But that said, the bit where the car sort of bursts through the flames and Penguin realizes he's fucked is one of the best moments in the film for me. Like, I really love that, just that little section. So, you know, in my ideal version of this film, that car chase isn't in there, but in the version that I saw, there are bits I enjoyed.
What about the stuff at the end in the square gardens?
Again, like, part of me felt like the reason it was in the movie is because they wanted some spectacle. And having done a sort of street-level detective story, it's very hard to then ramp that up into something visual and exciting. At the same time, I think that sequence justifies itself through what it reveals about the way the character has sort of hit his turning point and what he's realized about how to be Batman. So, again, didn't love it initially, but I think, again, on the second watch, I sort of really felt it's good that it's there. I liked the fact that there's a lot of gunplay, and even then he does not resort to shooting anyone or using guns. In fact, he's very anti-gun the entire movie, and vocally so. To the point of not letting other people use guns or not wanting to, where he like tells Jim Gordon, like, no guns. And he's like, hey man, that's your thing. yeah, I think there's a lot to love about that sequence. Ultimately,
I just think that by the time we've got past that final confrontation with the Riddler, the film has kind of gone off the rails a little bit. Like, it doesn't, like, it feels so sure of itself and certain and specific all the way up to that. And then that final sequence felt to me like it was out of a different movie almost. It kind of, like, the aesthetic felt different, and the Riddler goons, like, kind of, I was like, is this an exciting climax?
This is the thing I was saying earlier, which is the you know, the sequence of events where he goes in, gets Falcone, brings him out, Falcone gets assassinated, and then they bust in on the Riddler and arrest the Riddler. That is like the payoff for 2 hours that you've been watching, and you're like, oh, this is fucking great. Like, they did it. They've you know, solved the problem.
And again, it does feel a little bit like The Dark Knight, where he has his showdown with the Joker, and then it's like, okay, but the actual thing that you need to stop is happening elsewhere, and you go off and do it. It's like, yeah, but there what you're running off to is Two-Face. who is this other really compelling presence in the movie.
Yeah.
And here we're running to fight the incel movement. who again just didn't really, I feel like that was introduced too late. I would have liked the idea of this kind of maybe community like glomming onto the Riddler as the movie went on, but it comes out of nowhere as a reveal at the end of the film. And then, I don't know, I just don't buy that they would be that organized. Like we saw what this is. we saw what this is in real life in the Capitol riots.
Yeah.
It's
a mess.
It's not that.
You also had the mayor figure, Real, was that?
Yeah, name? Real.
You know, Bella Real.
Like, you have that Bella Real, you have that in the mix as well in that sequence, and that's a dynamic that I feel like the movie wants us to have some kind of thought on, but has given us nothing.
I couldn't figure out what the take was there because it felt like a very specific choice for her to be young black female. But I just couldn't get the read on what they were trying to say with her and whether she was supposed to be a positive like part of the answer, because the whole film seemed to be saying like it doesn't matter who's in charge.
I mean, I think
that's all set up for the sequel.
I think the idea for that was that she's not a part of the system, and
yeah,
like she's sort of, again, I feel like they could have done a bit more with it in it had they acknowledged that actually the other guy was supposed to win and now the Riddler's killed him, and that's actually a bit of a wrench.
Mm.
For us, like that's a spanner in the works, because she needs to be bribed now or something, and they didn't really address that.
Right.
But again, maybe that's the sequel. You know, who knows?
Is she a Alexandra Ocasio Cortez sort of stand-in in some ways? Perhaps, I don't know. But that, you know, the movie doesn't do anything with that. Leaves it that she's the mayor of the city at the end.
Yeah,
of the movie,
she gets a decent chunk of screen time as well.
So maybe
there's more coming with that.
Just quickly about that final sequence. I think part of the reason I give it a bit of a pass is because, like, ultimately, this is a Batman movie, right? And as much as Batman is about the detective work and the, you know, stealth, there is also the aspect of Batman which is grappling Hook off the side of a building, beating up people with guns. So up until that point, he sort of hadn't done any of that stuff, and I get why they might want to put that sequence in there as well. So they're doing all of Batman, not just one angle.
Do you think they looked at the script and were like, okay, yeah, cool, we made the movie we want to make. Wait, hold on, Matt, you haven't done any of the building stuff in the fighting on the and an alleyway. Oh, fuck, okay. Tap. At the end, he goes to the Madison Square Gardens, Gotham Square Gardens, and the guy's in the mask and does a punching and does a spray. Maybe, could be.
I think this ties into it, James. What were the two things about Batman that you teased us with at the start of the movie that you thought that this did specifically as a take on this character that were I'm assuming one is the gun thing.
Yeah, one is having a version of Batman who is explicitly like, no, don't kill them and don't use guns, because that's not who we are. Like a version of Batman who is explicitly the hero. And I found it interesting that the kind of people who are the villains in this movie, like the sort of right-wing intel gun nuts, are the sort of people who are also, at least in some way, overlap with Zack Snyder's fan base. So I thought a lot of that, like, I found myself wondering, are they going to come out of this movie going, like, holy fuck, Matt Reeves made us the villains, like, fuck him. And I have seen some of that.
I think generally there is a divide in fandom between Batman fans and Snyder fans. I think there are people who are...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's Snyder first, Batman second.
Yeah, but the people who were fans of Snyder's Batman are not mad keen on Matt Reeves' version, and that might have been true of any other version.
I think that's the case. I think they wouldn't have liked anything.
Yeah, but they definitely see portions of this movie as being an attack on their beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, that Batman, that, you know, that to be a fan of and to have defended online for a number of years, that Batman,
Guns Batman. You know,
yes, it is a large portion of that has had to be guns. So for this film to come out and very swiftly say, and, you know, explicitly say, no, we don't use those. Like, he literally says, I can't remember if it's Selena or to Gordon.
He says it to both of them. He says to Gordon,
like, put your gun away. No, we don't. Yeah,
he put your gun away, and Gordon says, like, no, that's your thing. Mm. And he says it to Selena as well. He takes the gun off her and says, like, this is their weapon or whatever. Like, we don't kill people.
Yeah.
If you kill people, you'll be like them. So that for me is the Snyder stuff.
That was thing one. I knew that was coming.
Yeah.
So let's go full Dr. Seuss and find out what thing two is.
So the stuff where it's the moment where he stares into the eye of the Riddler guy, he's unmasked and has that I'm vengeance moment and realizes, like, oh, actually, vengeance is my only thing. For me, like, the problem with the Nolan version is that he's so sort of single-minded and focused on I have to get back at everyone for you know, taking down crime, like, to the exclusion of all of his personal life and his, you know, individual health even. Like, at the start of Dark Knight Rises, he's properly knackered, like, because he's just given everything to this one-man war, even to the extent that at the end of that movie, he just has to quit being Batman because he physically can't continue anymore.
I'm pretty sure I saw him blow up in the bat.
Yeah, he's dead. Yeah. He died in the pod.
Sure.
I don't know if you saw some kind of mad Michael Caine fever dream at the end of that.
He drank too much Campari in Italy. That's not true.
Yeah,
I will never see the spinning top fall. So who knows?
But yeah, so. Like, Nolan's version is like, oh, if you were going to be Batman, how would that mentality affect you?
And oh, you'd quit.
Yeah, like, it would destroy you psychologically and physically, and eventually you'd have to stop.
Yeah.
So, like, this version of Batman has extra nuance. And, like, again, at the end of Dark Knight Rises, like, at the end of The Dark Knight, Batman's thing is like, oh, people can't like me. Yeah. I have to be the thing they hate.
I have to be the Dark Knight, right?
Yeah. Like, I have to sacrifice everything to, you know, and people are going to loathe the Batman and I can't do it anymore because it's too dangerous.
He's not the hero that Gotham wants, but that Gotham needs. But he's not the White Knight that represents.
Yeah. In this movie, he comes out of the shadows and says, no, actually, I can't just inspire fear. I have to also inspire hope. And like I say, he gets the flare and he leads the people out of danger into safety, and explicitly the mayor and the kid. And, you know, he's later on, the woman's on the stretcher and she's thanking him for saving her. Like, this is a version of Batman who is not afraid to be liked by people and to do more for the city in terms of showing them what good can exist. I just found it to be like a sort of rejection of Nolan's kind of one man war on crime version of Batman, in that it encompasses more of what the character represents as a superhero, basically. And it wasn't afraid to be a superhero. In a way, it reminded me of No Way Home, in that that ends with a version of Spider-Man that feels like the comics character and, you know, the fully realized version of Spider-Man. And this does the same with Batman for me.
I'm trying to figure out what's the more offensive thing to me. sitting through 3 hours to get to the version of Batman that we want to see, or three movies, see the version of Spider-Man that we want to see.
as experiences, they stand alone. It's fine.
James, is there anything that you think he specifically rejects of the Tim Burton Batman? How does he say fuck you to Tim Burton?
I mean, the Tim Burton version is, you know, capable of cracking a smile.
Oh, yeah. How dare he? Okay, cool. Can I just check, is there a post-credits on this?
There is, but it's garbage.
What is it? As we established, I was busy looking under my chair for the, for the keys. I didn't make up that story, by the way. It's all dead.
It's a short story, too. It was a short story you told in a very short amount of time.
It is a black screen with a Riddler question mark on, like a computer screen. It says something like, "The end?" question mark. Like some properly, like as minimal as you could possibly get.
Okay,
it's not the time.
You know, I think it's good that the Riddler isn't dead at the end of this movie. I think, and that he meets the Joker as discussed. But like, God, are we? Is this a kind of a ASM 2 style setup for a Sinister Six, but for Batman bullshit over the next couple of movies? I worry.
I think that, as you know, I think it's smart to keep them on the board. I wouldn't be coming back to a second movie and going, "Let's do a bit of the Riddler. Let's do a bit of Joker." But maybe, you know, in a third film, all of the inmates of Arkham escaping could be fun. You know, it was always fun when the Scarecrow popped back up in the in the Dark Knight sequels. So. I mean, that's a much, much better performance of character, but still.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd be as happy not to see the Riddler again ever as anything.
I think we will, and I think, you know, deal with that.
one scene cameo I'll be fine with.
I'm the Riddler! Okay, you know, do a He could sing like he could sort of sing that as the soundtrack to some heist that the Joker and Mr. Freeze and Face or Harley Quinn or some fucking bullshit do.
Give me a 3 hour loop of that on YouTube.
in fairness, right? I think the best quality of this movie is that it feels like it only exists for this movie. Especially coming off the back of the DCEU, which I think we can all agree was a botched experiment.
I don't think it's either.
The fact that I sat down and watched one Batman story that took place in a world that only existed for Batman, I was like, actually, kind of refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, well, it only exists for Batman, but I so disagree that it only exists for this movie. I think there's so much in this, as we've talked about, that is really set up for
sequelable
stuff that could be sequeled, but that if it wasn't, wouldn't feel out of place.
No, I don't think so. I thought that the Batman Catwoman relationship was not
fulfilled. That felt like Act One. Yeah,
The Joker moment is not. It is a pure setup for future stuff. The Penguin stuff is pure setup. I disagree.
The Joker scene is the only thing I think in this movie that
the penguin, you know, the final thing I think when you
no,
when
but like I say, it's about it's about the texture of Gotham's underworld. Like you kill off the head guy and there's someone else waiting. You don't need to see the rise. You don't need to see the 10-part HBO series.
Except that
the fact that they're doing it is immaterial to this movie.
Yeah, but the difference is that me and you and Joe and most and lots of people know that the Penguin is a Batman villain. And so...
Yeah, so, okay, what do you think happens after the end of this movie?
With the penguin. Penguin? I guess I'm going to have to watch the HBO Max.
But this is my point, right? You know what happens with that character. You don't need to see it. If they start the next Batman movie and it, like, the Penguin is the boss of all crime in Gotham, you'll be like, well, of course.
You
know, filling in the gaps, whatever. If they never made a Batman movie, you still know how that character ends up, right? You know that he's going to tangle with Batman again.
Yeah, fine.
Like I say, you don't need to see it happen.
I agree that it's refreshing to feel like you are watching a movie that exists in its own world and is not tied down, by the way. And this is not just a DCU thing, this is an MCU thing.
It's
well.
A Marvel thing as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it's just seeing a movie that exists in its own in its own world and feels self-contained and its own thing is refreshing. However, I also did feel like it felt like a film that was going to get at least two sequels.
I think the last point I'd make on all of that is that, you know, you go back to the previous version of this, which was the Zack Snyder version of this, and it, you know, perhaps like he, but you know, Snyder himself probably like kind of reached too far wide to cover the style of a Wonder Woman film, an Aquaman film, you know, the Superman, the Batman, with all of their kind of complex universes. In a way, this as a bit of a reset, you know. I think I kind of can, and I'm excited to see Matt Reeves with his vision that you see in this film. You know, but he could be a kind of a Feige type author for future Batman shows, spin-offs. You know, they've already announced that they're making Batgirl, right? That we have to presume is going to be the daughter of Jim Gordon's.
Do we have to?
I'm sure that's what that is. That's what it is.
That's what I don't want. I don't want that.
I think that's...
Make a Batgirl movie, make it its own thing.
I might be wrong, but I am 99% sure that that's...
I'm not saying you're wrong, I don't want it. I don't want it.
Right, but I think my point would be just, you've got Matt Reeves and perhaps, and a more focused kind of universe, right, the Bat universe... is more focused, and I think that I'm excited. You know, I'm willing to explore more of what the Matt Reeves Bat universe is going to be, even if he's not directed the stuff in a way that's different to Zack Snyder's DCEU stuff. That's just too big for one person. You know, Kevin Feige is perhaps the exception, not the rule, and a Matt Reeves Bat universe is more. Is the model going forward, perhaps?
I just want to, before we wrap up, I mentioned already, but I think there's some good craft gone into this movie. I would shout out definitely Michael Giacchino's score, and also Greg Fraser's cinematography, because I think it is quite an achievement to have a film that feels this dark and murky, and that you're really it's constantly raining and you're scraping around the underbelly of this fucking cesspool of a city. But I don't think, when I think of it, I don't think of it as being like visually muddy or unclear. Like, I always felt like I knew what was going on, that scenes were correctly lit. So yeah, I think good job on Greg Fraser's part.
The thing I want to praise is the fact that this movie has almost no jokes in it. Like, there are a couple of funny moments, but there's no wisecracking, and yet it doesn't feel like I wasn't having a good time. Because one of my problems with basically any blockbuster movie that isn't funny is that sometimes I'm sitting there going like, this is stupid and I'm not having fun.
Listen,
but in this movie,
just name the Fast and Furious movies if you're going to do that. They're great. Like,
I think it takes a lot, especially when you're doing a Batman movie, to not fall back on jokes. And just because the idea is sort of inherently ridiculous, right? And I think Matt Reeves did a really good job of staying the course and being true to his vision and not being like, I'm just going to put in some fan-pleasing wisecracks here.
There are definitely moments. There were moments early in the film where the first few times you see him in a bright light in the cape, you know, I mean Batman, and he just looks so stupid. And it's just like, you know, yeah, it's sort of a less confident director would have put in some a line referencing how dumb he looks from a passerby or a criminal, and they would have got beaten up or whatever. But actually, yes, the movie has the courage of its convictions to say, yeah, look, it's fucking Batman. It's a guy in a cape and he dresses as a bat. It is dumb and he's like sort of mentally ill. But we're going to, you know, we accept that, and we're going to try and tell us, you know, an adult story based off that. And we're not going to make fun of that or deflate that. And I appreciate that also. I agree.
Cool. Okay. So that was The Batman. Do we have a pitch, Reese?
Sure.
Who would direct the film adaptation of the story of My Lost Keys?
Because I think it has to be who's the Thai director who does this like slow cinema stuff, 6 hours, and it's about a guy goes to the grocery shop. I think it would be that director if that's done.
I was thinking Miri Bill Ceylan would be a good choice, that's
done. That's not
what if I buy the script but we attach Michael Bay.
Interesting. Okay. But I think the problem there is that it would be a Quibi, but Quibi is
it could be a TikTok. Michael Bay's first TikTok.
The way you said it could be a TikTok, it's as though you had just been explained what TikTok was.
TikTok allows you to do 10-minute videos now. As long as you can stand people talking for 10 minutes at a speed that suggests they've ingested more caffeine than you've had in your entire life, that is fine.
Isn't it depressing to think that probably there are kids now who think of TikTok as like, oh, what, my granddad's app? Ooh, I'm on, insert new app now here that me, James and Joe have never heard of. It's depressing. I'm sick. I want to be sick on my table here.
What's the pitch, Reese?
My pitch is, my sweet, sweet boy Barry Keoghan is now in the Matt Reeves universe and in the Marvel Universe, of course, but that's not enough. We need more Barry Keoghan. We need more Druig level energy. So, and also, I've been reading all these fucking bullshit stories about, oh, Madame Webb has cast this actor from Teen Wolf reboot as Stephen Jiminy. So, cast for me. Barry Keoghan in specifically the Sony adapts the Marvel Universe of wonderful
Sony Universe of Marvel characters, right?
Yeah, and so we can stitch together some kind of like Marvel DC / Spider-Man integrated universe. Cast for me Barry Keoghan in the Spider-Man Marvel Sony Universe. TMNLCLLPICIQ. James, you go first.
Thanks for that.
I think possibly I'm thinking a goblin character, possibly the heroic version of the Green Goblin. I don't know whether you want that to be Phil Yorick or not, but I think heroic Green Goblin.
God damn it, it's a good answer. Fuck, I thought I'd thrown in like a proper like, bowl of horse shit in terms of this question. That's good.
You hit my wheelhouse of like obscure shit Spider-Man characters.
Barry Keoghan is like Phil Yorick, the good goblin. That's good. Joe, tough for you now. But I love Keoghan. I feel like me and you, we get Keoghan more. We're on the same page with him. And so I think if you can tap into that, the point is yours.
Okay, so I would cast him as the Hypno Hustler.
Who?
Oh, you don't know the Hypno Hustler, Reese?
Come on.
Oh, that's interesting. Reese.
A 70s Spider-Man villain who rides the disco wave.
Yeah, he's a psychedelic performer with a guitar that can actually hypnotize people. So he's the lead singer of a band. They're called the Mercy Killers. He starts off by tricking people into like giving people, the audience, giving them their wallets and stuff. But obviously, those powers can be used for much greater ill. And I think Barry Keoghan would really fit that that vibe as the Hypno Hustler.
How long did you spend on Wikipedia?
Exactly. How much?
I Googled worst Spider-Man villains and then frantically searching while you were talking to find the one that felt like it might be a slight bit of a fit.
James takes the point, and it's he actually sort of thought about it and then came to a correct conclusion.
I don't know enough of that. The one that I was considering as a serious answer was the villain of the Spider-Verse, the guy who's going around killing all the Spider-Mans.
Morlin?
Yeah, him. That's what that's where I was going to go originally. And I thought, I can't remember his name, so I'm not going to do it.
I think I would have if you could have grasped that in your mind grapes, I would have given you the win on that.
Well, let me tell you this. If I could go back in time and have done it correctly, I wouldn't.
James, the point is yours, sir. The point is yours.
Not undeservedly.
Agreed.
Okay, so that is it for this week's show. As we mentioned extensively at the start of the episode, this is kind of our last normal format episode on the main feed. So if you want to hear us talking about all of the Marvel Disney Plus shows and all of the future new releases, then head over to Patreon.
Is Morbius the next new release?
Yes, of course it is.
Yeah, getting in those sweet pay. You know, you've got to come to Patreon to hear what we think of Morbius. So head to patreon.com/cinematicuniverse, £3 a month, and you can subscribe to that. We will still be around on the main feed with those monthly episodes. And also the release of our archive of episodes as well. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on your podcast app of choice. Give us a rating. If you want to get in touch, we're on Twitter @Cine_Verse. I'm @JoeCunningham14. James is @JamesHunt and Reese is @Reese. We'll be back in a few weeks' time with the first of those news episodes. And apparently Morbius and Moon Knight over on the Patreon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.